good flags are furled. It's the greatest race in the world.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
And now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing. Each year in the month of May, Speedway owner Tony Hallman gives the command to start your engines to the gentlemen who race. They've made their pilgrimage to Indianapolis in search of speed, fame, and glory. 33 proud men will try, but only one will win. Most racing drivers say that their lifetime ambition will be fulfilled if only they might cross the finish line first at Indianapolis. Many have done so before my very eyes. This is Sid Collins, speaking to you from the Master Control Tower at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, as I've done for more than 25 years. Each year, we've had the honor of broadcasting around the world to over 100 million people. My fine crew and I have covered the greatest spectacle in racing from before the green flag is waved to after the checkered flag has fallen to that very exclusive piece of Indiana real estate known as Victory Lane. But the track and the race were there long before our entry on the scene. Its history stretched all the way back to the start of this century. The enterprising city of Indianapolis played a major part in the early history of the automobile and was listed as the nation's second largest manufacturer of passenger cars. In Indiana, 250 different makes were produced, with 64 of these being assembled in the Indianapolis area alone. An energetic businessman named Carl Fisher owned the very first car in Indianapolis before the turn of the century. He hit upon the idea of building a huge, oval-shaped track 6 miles from downtown to be utilized as a proving ground. He reasoned that firms from all over the nation could test their products in racing, and admission charges would make the track a paying proposition. The sprawling Pressleaf and Corn in the Hoosier heartland was bought by Fisher and several associates in early 1909, and a 2.5-mile racetrack, surfaced with crushed rock and tar, took shape by midsummer. Balloon and motorcycle incident marred 3-day racing meet in August, after which time the track was shut down. 3,200,000 bricks were laid by December 1909 to make it smoother and safer. Short races were run through 1910, but the crowds began to dwindle. Fisher and his partners came up with a plan to stage one major event on Memorial Day, May 30, 1911. The distance of 500 miles was determined, since the race would take about 7 hours and there would still be time for spectators to get to Indianapolis and back home again before dark. 75,000 fans turned out for the dawn-to-dusk extravaganza. Ray Haroon, design engineer for the Marmon Passenger Car Company, won that first race at a speed of almost 75 miles an hour. Haroon talked with us many years later in front of the Starting Tower Pagoda, and he reminisced about his history-making day.
Mr. Haroon, how long was the race in which you won in 1911?
Well, it was about 6 hours and some odd minutes.
These days, we can pretty well cross the country and back in that time, can't we?
That's right.
How does the track look to you since the old days when you first raced here?
Well, it looks a lot better. When I first raced here, it was brick and it wasn't too smooth.
What kind of a car did you have, sir?
I was a Marmon.
And have you noticed many improvements these days?
Oh, yes. They only weigh about half as much and about four times as much horsepower.
In 1912, another local firm won when a national, driven by a hometown boy, Joe Dawson, won the race at the expense of the great Ralph DePalma. DePalma led all but the first two laps and the final two, then tried to push his broken Mercedes to victory, but failed. 3 years later, in 1915, he won the race. But he would always remember 1912, when he lost.
Hard to forget for the one I did not finish in 1912, because everyone liked to talk about it.
That's right.
Everyone reads about it. There have been more lines written about the race that I did not win than there did on the one that I did win in 1915. Of course, they call it hard luck. Well, I often say that I don't think it was hard luck. It's just breaks of the game.
Great European drivers like Jules Gou, Brané Thomas, and Dario Resta won pre-war races. But when racing resumed after World War I, names like Howdy Wilcox, Gaston Chevrolet, Tommy Milton, Joe Boyer, and Jimmy Murphy brought car names such as Frontenac, Miller, and Duesenberg to the public's attention. The speeds were fantastic. On a track designed for lap speeds of 75 to 80 miles an hour, Ralph DePalma's nephew, Peter DiPaolo, won the race in 1925 with an average speed of over 101 miles per hour. Pete was ecstatic when we asked him about that day, which was to live in his heart forever.
All through the race, I had the confidence that I was going to win. Matter of fact, I'd sing. I'd go down the backstretch singing, oh, boy, I'm lucky. I'll say I'm lucky. Get over, buddy, let me by. I didn't say nice words all the time, but it was very, very interesting, and they all thought I was going too fast, and the weather was terribly hot. It was 96 temperature. So you can imagine what the track temperature must have been. They said he'll never make it, he'll never hold it, but as a matter of fact, after the first 25 laps, I could look back the entire length of the home stretch, nobody in sight. And that's where I tell them I enjoy my most pleasant thrill. Every time I cross a line, all alone, $100, $100, $100, it was a marvelous feeling.
Another man destined for speedway immortality was a relief driver in 1911. He had his career cut short, but he left for Europe in World War I to join the U.S. Air Corps in France. He came home as America's leading air ace, never to drive a race car again. When Carl Fisher initiated his project to develop the swamplands of Miami into the resort area to become Miami Beach, Florida, the Speedway presidency passed to James Allison. Allison was an aircraft engine magnate, and in 1927, he and the air ace Captain Eddie Rickenbacker got together in Indianapolis.
Very frankly, I came down to buy the Allison Engineering Company from Jim Allison. And he said, no, I don't want to sell it. I live in Florida in the winter, and I want someplace to put my feet in the summer and watch the wheels go round. But he said, why don't you buy the Speedway? And that was the way it started. I said, I hadn't thought of it, so I made a check of it very carefully and had some financial interests in Detroit who said, if you find something that's worthwhile, why, let us know. Well, it was quite evident to me that Carl Fisher was through with it, and Jim Allison was the only one left that had anything to do with it, and that he was through, and that if someone didn't buy it and perpetuate it, why, you wouldn't have a speedway. And if I hadn't have bought it, it would have been subdivided, and automatically Indiana and Indianapolis would have lost the one big thing they've got that's known around the world.
The Indianapolis 500 had become an American institution. Frank Lockhart, Louis Meyer, Billy Arnold, Wild Bill Cummings, Floyd Roberts, Wilbur Shaw, Rex Mays, Ted Horn, Ralph Hepburn, Fred Frame, Maury Rose, and many, many more etched their names into auto racing lore. The speeds kept climbing. By 1941, we were engaged in a Second World War, and auto racing stopped. The Indianapolis Speedway stood vacant and abandoned, and when the war ended, the stands and the track surface were in ramshackle and decrepit condition. Eddie Rickenbacker was deeply involved as Eastern Airlines president, and he wanted to sell the Speedway. The three-time winner Wilbur Shaw fought to save the facility. He induced a Terre Haute industrialist and sportsman, Anton Hallman Jr., to purchase the track in November of 1945. Tony Hallman told us of his longtime love for the racetrack.
First of all, I'm a native Hoosier, and in my early years, before I first attended the 500-mile race, why, I had the opportunity of sitting on the curb over in Terre Haute and watching the old automobiles on their way to Indianapolis to attend the race. And it wasn't until about 1914 till my father brought me along and let me see my first race here at Indianapolis.
In 1946, the first Indianapolis 500 was run under the auspices of Tony Hallman and Wilbur Shaw. And George Robeson became the first post-war winner at an average speed of 114 miles per hour. In 1947, Maury Rose drove the Blue Crown Special to his second Indy victory. His teammate, Bill Holland, led most of the race until a confusing easy sign message on the pit board caused him to slow down and unknowingly relinquish his lead to Rose. Holland came in second. In 1948, the finish was the same. Rose first, Bill Holland second. But 1949 was to be Holland's year. From my post on the number one turn, the cars roared past me on the pace lap.
Here they come around the southwest turn, 32 times before this pace car has left the field around the southwest turn into the south straightaway as the drivers get the feel of their cars. On some, Lady Luck will shine just as the sun is shining this very moment. The rainbow color mingles with the asphalt of the 660-foot south straightaway directly in front of us. Today, there are seasoned veterans in these cars, as well as some youngsters trying their wings for the first time. Here comes the entire pace lap, the 33 cars in front of us, and there goes the red automobile pace car. Just a few moments, they start the 200 trips around this magnificent speedway course. George Lynch in 26 adjusts his goggles. Jack McGrath grits his teeth as they pass us here. Now the spectators in the back stretch are going to get their first glimpse of the splendorous procession. So for a verbal view of the backstretch, back to the pagoda.
The race began with top contenders Duke Nealon and Rex Mays dueling for the lead in two of the fabulous supercharged Novi cars, which have become great favorites. Nealon quickly pulled away from Mays and built up a terrific lead by the end of 23 laps to have his efforts thwarted by an accident. Jim Shelton described Nealon's plight.
This treacherous northeast turn has claimed another car, Duke Nealon, the powerful Novi number 54, after setting a blazing speed, lost the wheel coming in the northeast turn. The car skidded immediately, smacked the wall sideways, and burst into flames. It bounded off into another spin, and came back striking the wall head-on this time. Now at this point, Duke looked as if he loosened his safety belt and either jumped or was thrown from the racer. The car continued pancaking the wall and finally came to rest flush against the outside wall. Now at this time, fuel leaking from the wrecked car spread over the entire track, making it necessary for cars rounding the curve to cut at least 10 feet onto the sod on the inside of the track. They had to there to keep from going through that wall of flame. Some cars, however, had to go through the wall of flame caused by the leaking fuel. No other way around, as too many cars were bunched on the inside turf. No cars caught on fire, however. Very fortunate. Duke, meanwhile, scrambled to his feet and was picked up by an ambulance. The fire is out now, but the car, a complete wreck, remains flattened against the wall.
And later in Victory Lane, Hollywood movie star Linda Darnell was on hand to kiss the tenacious winner, Bill Holland. In 1950, 21 drivers took their rookie test, including the great Bill Vukovich and another eventual winner, Bob Swikert. The little dynamo, 5 foot 4 inch cigar-smoking Walt Faulkner, made history by establishing a pole speed of 134.343 miles per hour in a car owned by J.C. Agajanian, a man who was to become one of the most flamboyant race car owners over the next 25 years. We talked with Walt.
Walt, you seem to have some kind of a routine here that's setting the pace here at the Speedway this year, and that's holding that rubber ball in your right hand. Will you tell us why you do that?
Well, it's just an exercise for the hands and the wrist and the fingers. Just to keep them sharp all the time.
You keep on squeezing all the time.
That's right.
And since you brought that small rubber ball about the size of a ping pong ball to the track, the other drivers have been taking up the same idea.
Well, I've seen quite a few of them floating around.
Well, you can go in the rubber ball business then, after
you get
out
of racing.
How about your superstition about peanuts, Walt?
Well, that dates back a long time ago. I'm taking a dim view of them, period.
You don't like peanuts around a race car?
Not at all.
Do you mind the color green? That's another race driver's superstition.
Well, I don't like it.
And how about women in the pits?
Well,
I don't like them around the car either.
No.
There was a rumor of a cracked block in the car of 1949 AAA driving champion Johnny Parsons on the morning of the 1950 race. But it was Parsons who pulled into Victory Lane after rain fell at 345 miles. It was the first time since 1926 that the race had been red flagged and stopped because of rain. That year, film stars Clark Gable and Barbara Stanwyck were on hand to make the movie To Please a Lady. We were all in Victory Lane. I was there for the first time. It was a mad dash down the steps of the old pagoda through the rain-soaked crowds. As I leaned over the white-hot exhaust pipe of Parsons' car, I singed my trousers. The crowd was pushing me closer against the car. This may explain the very brief interview with Johnny Parsons.
Another great big kiss coming in here from Barbara Stanwyck. She's really hanging on. That's the fourth one she's given now. Johnny, seven other words, coast to coast, our mutual microphone now.
Barbara?
Well, I'm awfully glad that we won the race. But as I said before, I'm sorry it rained. But that's about all I got to say.
The big story in 1951 was the return of the Novi car and one of its most famous drivers, Duke Nealon. He had suffered serious burns from his crash in 1949. He failed to qualify in 1950. But he put his Novi on the pole in 51 with a new record speed of over 136 miles an hour. the Iron Duke talked with us about his comeback the night before the race.
Well, I know, Duke Nalen, that coast to coast, folks will be watching for you tomorrow to see if you can keep up that tremendous pace you did in 1949.
Well, I would like to pick up where I left off, Sid, along about 24 laps, and see if the one that did so much for me, as you well know, a little prayer I say before I start that race, maybe we can carry right on to the end of the race. I'd love to get into that winner's circle some way, Sid.
Well, we certainly wish you the very best of luck.
Wilbur Shaw reviewed what he had been doing in his role as president of the Speedway since the previous 500.
Wilbur, I know as a goodwill ambassador for the Speedway, you've done a lot of traveling since last May 30th, when you were on the same mutual microphone with our good friend Bill Slater.
That's
Where have
right.
you been?
Oh, gosh, we've been every place, Sid, really, from coast to coast and border to border. And I've been over on... with Bill and his hunting and fishing club also.
Is that right? Well,
that's
wonderful.
Right.
Well, Wilbur, I know the track is in wonderful shape, and with the fastest qualification speeds ever, we'll have the greatest race ever tomorrow.
There's no question about it, Sid, and we're delighted with such a competent field, and with the promise of good weather tomorrow, we're just overjoyed, really.
Thank you, Wilbur Shaw. We certainly wish you were going to be in the race, too.
The race was won by 40-year-old Lee Wallard, driving the car with the smallest cubic inch displacement in the event. The attrition rate was very high, with only 8 cars finishing. Wallard's exhaust pipe fell off, a shock absorber broke, and he lost his brakes with only 12 laps to go. And 3-time winner Maury Rose flipped upside down on the third turn into a muddy infield. Rose crawled from the cockpit, jammed a small pipe into his mouth, stuck his hands in his pockets, shrugged and said, "Some days you just can't make a nickel," and he retired from racing, never to drive a race car again. After the race, we ran to Victory Lane to greet the victorious Lee Wallard.
Hi, Sid.
Wonderful.
Boy, am I happy to win this go. I can thank those mechanics, Merle Ballinger, the boss, and George Soleil, Buster, and Frenchie, all of the boys. They sure did a good job, because if this little beauty didn't run, I sure couldn't win it.
In 1952, Freddie Agabation sat on the pole with the revolutionary Cummins diesel-powered machine, and Chet Miller started his 16th and final 500. Jack McGrath took the lead in the early stages. But on the 9th lap, Bill Vukovich, who was driving in his second 500, came from the back of the pack in a new Roadster to overtake McGrath and lead for most of the afternoon. With 10 laps to go, it appeared that Vuki would win. But with only 8 laps left, the crowd came to its feet as Vukovich's car slowed in the third turn, scraped the wall to help stop the car. A 20-cent steering pin had broken.
So Vukovich, who was within 8 laps of possibly winning this year's 500, is out of the race. And Troy Ruttman, in car number 98, a seemingly dark horse before this race today, is now leading. He's in first place, 3 laps ahead of Jim Rathman in car number 59. All Ruttman has to do is keep a speed of about 118 or 20 miles an hour and coast on in.
This quirk of racing luck allowed 22-year-old Troy Ruttman, the youngest winning driver in Speedway history, to take the lead and also the checkered flag. This was the last time ever for a dirt car to win at Indianapolis.
Starter Seth Klein, for over 30 years, the official starter here at the 500-mile race, has number 98. Here's the checkered flag for Troy Ruttman. And Troy Ruttman in car number 98, the Agaginian Special, wins the 1952 500-mile race.
In 1952, Stark Wetzel's Rookie of the Year trophy was introduced, and Art Cross was its first recipient. In 1953, the heat was stifling as race fans wilted in 98-degree weather. The steel monsters became streaking saunas while track temperatures climbed to 130 degrees. There were relief drivers for relief drivers that day, several of whom were carried off to the field hospital suffering from heat prostration. The popular Carl Scarborough collapsed in the pit area and succumbed. It was so hot in our broadcasting booth, we stripped off our shirt and shoes, with a handkerchief around our forehead to keep perspiration from dripping in our eyes. But it must have been unbearable for the drivers.
Now let's take it down to Luke Walton in the north section of the pits. Luke?
Yes, Seth, and standing right here now is Jimmy Rathman to tell us what happened to his car. Jimmy?
Well, nothing happened to the car. The car's running real good. It was just, I got sick from the heat. It's awful hot, and I was breathing fumes from the engine.
How about going back into the race, Jimmy? Do you plan on going back into the race?
Yes, I do. I feel good right now. I didn't get tired. I just got sick. All these big roadsters, this new type of car, why, they're pretty hot in there, and the boys are just getting sick from the heat.
Undaunted by a stroke of hard racing luck the previous year, Bill Vukovich returned to the Speedway to lead all but five laps. His desire to win was intense, as described by Luke Walton.
Well, you can call Luke the Iron Man of the 500-mile race of all time, because they flagged him in. And just a little while ago, Henry Banks told me that he was standing by for the Novi relief. And then just about 20 minutes later, he came down to the Vukovich crew, the fuel injection special crew, and they had him with his helmet on, ready to relieve Vukovich. When Vukovich came in, he said he did not want any relief. So he is the Iron Man of the race, and there he goes back on the track. He's in the lead, and he's going to drive it himself without any relief. Said this is the hottest day we've had in Hoosier Land since Wilkie accepted the nomination in Elwood back in 1940. Back to the pagoda.
And it was Bill Vukovich who steered his fuel injection special into victory lane at a speed of almost 129 miles per hour.
He's taking the helmet off, and the thing is really scarred, and boy, does he look like he's had a day out here. Wilbur Shaw whispers a few comments, and his wife, Esther, is right here to whisper a few words. Esther, would you tell Bill to move over here so we can get a word from Bill? Coast to coast, can you say just a word about how you feel on winning the race?
Oh, it feels all right. Everybody's happy to win.
Bill, did you think you'd want relief any time in the race?
How do you say?
Think you want relief any time in the race?
No.
Never want relief. There's an Iron Man, folks, and he's really tired and he can't hear a single thing.
Jack McGrath became the first man to qualify at a speed of over 140. He grabbed the pole in 1954. As only 4 miles an hour separated the slowest from the fastest car in the starting field. Anticipating a closely contested race, we talked to Gentleman Jack.
Jack, I know that sports writers, especially automobile sports writers around the country, will comment that this is very similar to Roger Bannister's 4-minute mile on the dirt and on the cinders. You're driving over 140 at the Speedway. How do you feel about it?
Well, it's something that you kind of dream in the back of your head someday you might be able to do, but it sounds so fantastic that I just can't hardly realize it yet, Sid.
Piston ring problems prevented Bill Vukovich from qualifying until the third day of the time trials. Then, once the 1954 race was underway, there were several lead changes, but Jack McGrath dominated the race until the halfway point when Vukovich took the lead. Jimmy Bryan, a rugged driver with incredible stamina, pressured Vuki for several laps, until a shock absorber broke on Brian's dirt car, eliminating him as a serious threat. It caused him to take a tremendous physical pounding over the brick surface for the last 100 miles. Vukovich took the checkered flag for the second year in a row, and Brian crossed the finish line right beside Vuki, but one lap back to earn second place. In 1955, Bill Vukovich returned, out to do something no man had done before, to win 3 500s in a row. Dinah Shore came from Hollywood to kiss the winner and sing the traditional Back Home Again in Indiana before the start of the race. She established another first. She asked the audience to join in, something her predecessors had never done.
And I long for my Indiana home. Will you sing the second verse with me? Let's go now. Back home.
Very beautifully done by Dinah Shore, and she's doing a second chorus for the benefit of the crowd once again as hundreds and hundreds of brilliantly colored balloons have been released from a gigantic tent and soar skyward to add to the pageantry preparatory to the start of this 39th annual running of the 500-mile race.
The great Wilbur Shaw had lost his life in a private plane crash on the eve of his birthday in October of 1954. The worldwide broadcast was dedicated to Wilbur's memory.
Born October 31, 1902 in Shelbyville, Indiana. Died October 30, 1954 near Decatur, Indiana, are the stone-cold facts to mark the passing of this man. But, in between, a long, long trail of accomplishment, of friendships, of inspiration by this little man with the infectious grin and the warm hand clasp. Never to be forgotten by us and by the thousands of others who respected and who loved him. The usual comment of any race driver is, "I'll be back next year." And that is equally true of Wilbur Shaw, even today. He'll be back because he'll never go away in the hearts of those who knew him. And if you didn't know him, you missed something great.
During the first 50 laps of the 55 race, an intense struggle developed between Jack McGrath and Bill Vukovich. Vuki finally took the lead, and McGrath dropped out with piston failure. Even as McGrath was stepping from his car in the pits, there was the announcement of a very dramatic accident and Jack Shapiro, stationed on the backstretch, was there to describe it.
Number 27 with Roger Ward got into trouble coming out of that southeast turn and started to slide down this backstretch. As he got to the bridge, he was sideways, and car number 39, driven by Johnny Boyd, the Sumar Special, went up and over him and bounced about 50 feet down the track. It lost all four wheels in the process. Roger Ward's car is only about 20 feet away from us, right out in the middle of the track still. Then car number 68, to keep from hitting all of the trouble that was happening, went off into the infield to my left, and it's sitting on the grass there. That's car number 68, the Westwood Gage Tool Special, driven by Ed Elysian. Then car number 42 did the same thing, the trailer special, driven by Al Keller. And Bill Vukovic, evidently going to the outside to miss the trouble, went over the wall, and that car is still burning over there. Now, the drivers, car number 27, Roger Ward, got out and is over on the grass. He looks to be all right. Ed Elysian didn't hit anybody, and he was all right. Car number 42 with Al Keller driving, he looks to be all right. Johnny Boyd was still sitting in the car when it came to a rest on its back. It was turned over, and they helped Johnny out of the car. He's sitting on the grass and looks to be all right. Now, what happened to Bill Vukovic, we have no information.
Back in the pagoda, sadly, we made the official announcement of the demise of the great two-time winner.
And we have some very, very disheartening news to relate to you. An official report from the Speedway Hospital here from Dr. Bonner, the director of medical staff at the Speedway. And in broadcasting this race now in our eighth consecutive year, we have never had to make such an announcement, and we're most regretful. Bill Vukovic, three-time winner of the 500-mile race, almost trying for his third consecutive today, trapped in his car in the backstretch, was injured fatally. Bill Vukovic has died as a result of injuries suffered on the backstretch in the accident reported to you earlier on this broadcast.
Consistently running among the leaders in the second half of the race, four-year veteran Bob Swiker took the lead for good during the last 100 miles and took the checkered flag in his John Zink Special. Charlie Brockman was there to greet him.
And now, Bob, we want to get a few words with you. How do you feel about this win?
Oh, wonderful. All the time you worry about the machine staying together. This is the first race I've ever finished here. I was just asking who got hurt of my Johnny Boyd. I saw his car upside down on the backstretch, and I was real worried about him.
Johnny's all right, Bob, and congratulations to you.
Thank you, Charlie.
On a very fine drive here today.
1956 was the year of Cagle's miracle. The Hoosier skies had drenched the speedway for several days, submerging the track in water, flooding the passenger tunnels, making the infield a quagmire. With the race just 2 hours away, it still looked doubtful it would start on time. But Ground Superintendent Clarence Cagle and his crew performed their miracle. Once the race was underway, Paul Russo came from the third row in his powerful Novi and was ahead after 10 laps, holding an impressive lead by the 22nd lap when Bill Frosch had this to report.
Paul Russo jumps out of his car, which smacked into the south wall down there, runs for the ditch. He's out of the car. The car is up by the wall, on the far wall. Paul is all right. He went into a skid as he came in to the southwest turn. The car went around, as we could see it several times, the back end hit the outside retaining wall, and believe me, as soon as Pat O'Connor and Pat Flaherty were by, Paul Russo was up out of there and ran all the way across the track, and he is over in the infield at the present time.
A battle for the lead developed between Pat O'Connor, former winner Johnny Parsons, and the pole sitter Pat Flaherty. For the second straight year, a dark horse winner took the checkered flag, and Charlie Brockman was in victory lane to greet the victorious Flaherty.
How does it feel to win this race?
Well, it feels terrific. I'll tell you, I got the greatest car owner and greatest mechanics in the world, boy. They just keep this thing running all day.
Well, you drove a consistent race all day. Were you worried about Sam Hanks less than 20 seconds behind you?
Well, I was concerned about him, but I wasn't too much worried. I just wanted to keep this running.
Well, you certainly did a beautiful job, Pat Flaherty. And what are your plans now?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to go to church and thank God.
And I imagine you'll probably be trying to figure out some ways to spend all that money.
Oh, I sure have. My wife will figure that out.
This was the start in 1957.
The race fever has reached the boiling point now, fans. The cars will pass us like a jet rocket, and here they come. There's the green flag, and the race is on. The first annual 500-mile race underway. Leading the pack into the turn is Pat O'Connor. Pick it up, Bill Frosch.
It is Pat O'Connor out in front, and here they come right by us. Ready, Agulhas in second, Sachs is third. Now to Bob Roone.
And still out front is Pat O'Connor. In second place is Rutman now, as Sachs is moving into third. And on down to Bernie Herrmann as they roll by us here.
Okay, Bob, here they come now past the trees and coming down this way. And it's Pat O'Connor first. Bernie Agamation. And by Rutman. Stop down to Rutman right in the northeast turn.
On the northeast turn, they come into it. It's Pat O'Connor in front. And next to him, Bernie Agamation in second. Now they go into the northwest turn, and here is Jim Shelton.
Well, that's quite a surprise that Agamation is running second, and let's check him here. It is O'Connor and Agamation.
On his 12th try, 6 weeks short of his 43rd birthday, still the oldest winner to have received the checkered flag at Indy, Sam Hanks sped on his way to a big celebration.
Well, it's certainly a great thrill to see Sammy Hanks take the checkered flag, and there he is, the winner of the 500. What a great champion he's going to be. And here he comes around the southwest turn again for his extra lap. Sam Hanks winning the race by approximately 20 seconds, the same amount of time he was behind the leader last year, Pat Flaherty, at the very same stage.
And then on to victory lane with the winner.
And Sam Hanks, congratulations, boy.
Hi, Charlie. Well, we finally did it. It took us a long time.
You know, Sam, I believe you're crying.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Sam, three pit stops. Had you planned on that all the way?
No, we didn't. We kind of thought we'd only make two, but I saw the rubber was going pretty fast to stay with that guy, Russo. So I just figured, well, we got to let her all hang out, and if she uses four sets, well, she does. So we were real lucky to get two on the three.
You know, Sam, you must have worked your ulcer overtime, because last year you finished second only 21 seconds behind, and this year Jim Rathman was on the same lap with you.
Yeah, I know it kind of was reverse position, but I love to be on the other end, believe me.
Cigar-chomping Jimmy Bryan, a three-time national driving champion, was picked as the favorite in 1958. He had the same revolutionary lay-down engine car that the now-retired Sam Hanks had driven to victory the year before. Bryan commented about the role of favorite.
Do you like to be picked by somebody, or do you feel at all jinxed or superstitious about it?
Well, I don't feel jinxed or superstitious about it, Sid, but I wish they'd leave me alone. They've picked several riders that picked me in about 3 years and hadn't done me a bit of good.
Well, maybe I better not pick you then, huh?
Well, let's not this year.
Well, I think everybody certainly feels you should have a mighty good chance. They say the car and the driver combination is what wins this race.
When the race began, starting in single file from the pit lane for the second year in a row, a mix-up occurred, and the first row of cars passed the pace car and pulled away from the field. We were amazed to look out on the track and see just three cars going by.
The pace lap is completely confused now, with the first row just going by us, as Bernie Herrmann reported it on the back stretch. The first row of cars, Dick Rathman in the McNamara Special, Ed Elysian in the John Zink Special, and Jimmy Reese in the other John Zink car, are just going slowly, waiting for the rest of the field to catch them. Bill Vandewater, the official starter, is out there with the green flag, and they're trying to get the entire field together. So, Jim, what do you see up there on the north turn now?
Well, Sid, what I saw was 97, 5, and 16, Rathman and Elysian and Reese, and they were way ahead, but the race must be on, and Sid, pick it up.
Well, Jim, I hate to disappoint you and the fans, but the yellow flag is out, and Bill Vandewater says the race is not on. He has not called for the green flag. The boys were set to go, but the first line wasn't there. The pace car pulled off, and now Sam Hanks driving the pace car comes to a halt at the end of the pit area. So we're going to have a start of a race without a pace car, without the world's fastest flying start, with the pace car for the first time in the history of the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
After an extra pace lap, the race began, and Ed Elysian passed Dick Rathman down the backstretch to take the lead. As they came into turn three, Lou Palmer, making his Speedway Network debut, was waiting to describe the color. Instead, his first words uttered worldwide were unexpectedly dramatic.
And we've got an accident here. Car number five, the Zink Special, is the first to wreck. Another over the wall. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cars piled up here on the northeast turn. The 54 Novi into the infield. Car number 19 in the infield. 68 now down into the infield. And it's almost impossible to identify the others. Out of car number five now, it's Ed Elysian. And car number 91 against the wall. That is all that we can see at the moment. Further down the track, there are still others. One car has left this track, Sid, and did go over the retaining wall. That's all of the information that we can give you at the moment. We will check each and every car for you and report on all of them as soon as we can.
After the fatal accident involving the very popular Pat O'Connor, a pall was cast over the speedway. But the race was not stopped. It was run for 25 minutes under the yellow caution flag, minus almost one-third of the starting cars, while the track was cleared of debris. On the 148th lap, a rookie from Houston, Texas, named Anthony Joseph Foyt, hit an oil slick and blew a tire, forcing him to drop from the race. He finished 16th and said he'd probably be back to try it again someday. A running battle for first developed between George Amick and Jimmy Bryan in almost identical cars. But it was Bryan who persevered and finally won.
Feel real wonderful. I still think I'm dreaming, but the only thing that makes it bad is the crash down there on the first lap. As yet, I know nothing of it, but I know it was bad. So it does mar the victory today, believe me.
Well, Jimmy, no matter what happens, you will go down in the ranks of all-time greats. What are your plans for the rest of the year? Is it too soon to think about that?
I think I'll rest a while now.
As we moved around the track on the pace lap in 1959, we had to interrupt Bernie Herrmann on the backstretch because on the starting line, the defending champion, Jimmy Bryan, was fighting to get his car underway.
Come those cars. It's a shirt sleeve crowd watching. A gingham dress.
Bernie, let me interrupt you. I'm sorry, but something very exciting is happening on the main stretch. Number six, Jimmy Bryan, last year's winner, the car that won the race in 57 and 58, is not started. The cars are now coming around the north turn for the pace lap, and the car is being pushed toward the pits. J.C. Agajanian, who had cars here himself, ran out in the track. About 20 people have come out to help. They're still pushing, coming into the southwest turn, trying to get the car going.
That day, the lead changed hands 13 times between Johnny Thompson, Pat Flaherty, Jim Rathman, and Roger Ward. But in the last stages, it was Ward who controlled the race and led for the last 290 miles. As the day wore on, our race driver authority, Freddie Agabation, who had just retired from racing the year before, gave us some insight into driver's strategy.
Freddie Agabation has been watching this Ward and Rathman duel, and how do the drivers feel at this point? Are they cautious about one another, Freddie?
Well, frankly, Sid, what's actually taking place out there is a little duel between Rathman and Ward. They're checking each other out, see how much one has over the other, and I think they're just about done checking. They'll be racing real hard pretty
soon.
Well,
how do they find this out? What are they looking for in the other man?
Well, they finally pass the man and then set a pace ahead of him and see if they get past.
See,
in other words, if Ward now can get by Rathman, Rathman will have to up his speed a little bit more if he's got any more left. And they're checking each other out, and they're almost at a conclusion now. I'd say within about another 15 laps, they'll be running out there like a trophy dash, just like gangbusters.
Finally, it was Roger Ward, followed by Jim Rathman, 24 seconds behind, who steered his leader card special into victory lane.
Here we are at victory lane. Roger Ward pulling in after winning the 43rd annual Indianapolis 500-mile race. He's coming in being congratulated by his wife. They're pushing him around. He's getting a kiss from his wife. Roger Ward, we'd like to get a question from you for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network. How do you feel, Roger Ward?
Never felt better in my life. I'll say one thing. Well, thank you. Wonderful. There might be better drivers here, but there's certainly no better cars. I've got the best machine, the best crew, and the best owner in the world, believe me. I'd like to say hello to my youngsters out in California, Roger and David, and, I'm just so happy. I hardly know what to say.
In 1960, racing's equivalent of the four-minute mile was almost broken when a rookie, Jim Herdebees, swept around the famous oval at the incredible speed of 149.601 miles per hour. 1960 was also the first of two straight years when Eddie Sachs, the colorful clown prince of auto racing, captured the pole position. We talked with Eddie after he accomplished this for the first time.
Well, I knew I was driving towards victory lane, all right? And I just got so elated and so happy that I just started crying, and I'm just sentimental. I'm a sentimental type.
So a tough, hard-boiled race driver, as far as the average person is concerned, a guy who drives around here 2.5 miles in just a couple of winks over a minute, can cry when he sets a record.
Well, I realize that I'm following in footsteps of Rex Mays and Ted Horns and all of the great greats of automobile racing, and someday I'd like to be cherished as they are cherished now.
We talked further with Eddie Sachs about the difference between going 149 and 150 miles per hour.
One third of the time that it takes to wink your eye will make 150 miles per hour for Jim Herdebees. If he can just find now one third of the wink of an eye, he'll have hit the 150 mile per hour mark. And he'll be in orbit.
One of the hard luck drivers and one of the most popular was Tony Bettenhausen. This year, Tony was trying to qualify for his 14th race, and we asked him how it felt to have to wait a full year between attempts to achieve his dream.
This is something kind of hard to explain, Sid. You Naturally, the first year I came here, I wanted to win the race, but each year now, it's getting just a little bit tougher. We're getting more of our good equipment, and we have more of the drivers today that have actually graduated out of the midget field as I did. And I think that racing today is tougher than it is any time I've ever driven.
The dazzling new rookie, Jim Hurtubise, missed going 150 on his time trial run by 0.4 of a mile an hour. 35 years before, Pete DiPaolo electrified Indy fans by winning the 1925 race at an average speed just over 100 miles per hour. We talked to Herc about his remarkable run.
Jimmy, we had you on the air during the month here, and you were talking about perhaps beating Eddie Sack's record, but you weren't bragging about it. Today, did you have it in your mind definitely?
No, I was, like I told you the other day, said I was going to try and go as fast as I could. And the fellows, my pit crew, they come out each lap I went around and give me an okay sign, so I didn't know how fast I was going. Actually, until the last lap, they give me the 149. And, well, I didn't think I was going that fast, but I guess I was.
In one of the most exciting finishes ever, Roger Ward and Jim Rathman, who've been battling nose to tail, came around for the 190th lap, and Rathman regained the lead for four laps, a lead which had changed hands 29 times throughout the day. Ward regained the lead for the 10th time on lap 194. And then, with only four laps to go, Roger Ward was forced to slow down because of excessive tire wear, and Jim Rathman zoomed past on his way to victory.
All right, Jim Rathman just kind of taking it easy here. Boy, I don't know what happened. Roger Ward is really biting fingernails if he could. Here he comes now. Gee, he's dropping back considerably. Okay.
Here's the checkered flag for Jim Rathman, the winner of the 44th annual 500-mile race.
After coming in second three times, Rathman finally crossed the finish line first, and Luke Walton was there to welcome Jim to victory lane.
How do you feel after that most spectacular finish?
Pretty good. What happened to Ward?
He ran out of gas. You and Roger really put on a spectacular finish today.
Thank you.
What were you thinking about the last five laps, Jim?
I was thinking that Roger Ward had a little more steam than what I did. And I figured it was all lost. My right front tire was down to the cord, and I didn't know what to do. I just figured Roger had a little more horsepower than I did, and every time he wanted to, he could pass me.
Now stay tuned for more of the greatest spectacle in racing.